In the wake of Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh being accused of sexual assault as a teenager, many people have been sharing high school and college stories of their own, from things they witnessed to things that happened to them. Some people might even be reevaluating events that they first thought weren't a big deal, but they are now realizing they were a big deal. And maybe that's the problem when we talk about the sins of our teenage years. As teenagers, so many of us thought we knew what we were doing, but in so many ways we did not, especially when it came to issues surrounding sex and consent. So today, we made an editorial decision to talk about sex and consent, and how as parents, adults, and educators, how we need to be having these conversations with kids right now. Joining me live in studio to talk more about this are Megan Kohler, a licensed counselor who focuses on consent and sex positivity, State Representative Melissa Wintrow. Her career background is in women's studies. She was the women's studies director at Boise State University. She currently teaches a gender studies class there. And Annie Hightower, director of law and policy for the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
I know that's a long introduction, but this is such a critical conversation to be having in the time that we are living in right now. And I think a lot of parents are frankly terrified about talking about this to their kids. So Megan, I want to start with you because you actually teach classes.
I do.
For parents. What happens when they walk into one of these classes?
Well, it can be a bit daunting. Obviously, the topic is daunting. So even just getting them through the door is a really big deal. And I have parents from all different types of backgrounds, parents that are more progressive with their sexual views and are more open with speaking about their kids about sex. And then I have parents that maybe are more conservative in their views on sex or religious views, and they're just trying to figure out how can they maintain those but still create an open door policy about talking about this topic with their kids. So I have a variety of parents coming for a variety of needs, but everybody ends up leaving super satisfied and happy that they're getting these tools to be able to talk about these things with their kids. And that's what I do. I basically give them tools and strategies to have a continuing conversation about sex and about consent and healthy relationships to make sure that their kids are well-informed, they're able to have healthy relationships in the future, but also it prevents a lot of sexual abuse and misconduct because kids are able to talk about these things and ask for help and be able to identify when something's not right.
And that's part of the issue right there. Frankly, the big issue is that sometimes you fall into these gray areas, and then it's was this assault? Was this not? And Melissa, before we came on the air, you made, I think, a very good point that it's like, but we have to differentiate between consent and between something that is an assault.
Correct. And I think, you know, we're in a really pivotal time right now. Lots of people are talking to their kids. They have to. It's on TV, it's on the radio, et cetera. We should have been having these conversations all along. But what I think is really striking is that even in the Me Too movement and the Hollywood conflicts and so forth, even now we're not talking about gray areas. We're talking about folks, men who have crossed physical boundaries in some very violent ways. And it's not about a mixed gray area. It is about an assault. And I think that's what's kind of fascinating is now we're kind of going to this place in our psyche where we have to have these other conversations. And really, we need to ask the question in our culture about why is it, what kind of conditions have we set to create an environment where men are getting away with these crimes and women have not been coming forward? The thing that's changed really is that women are now coming forward in masses. And I wish I could say I was surprised. I've received phone calls and contacts in the last week from folks who have been victimized and dealing with all the trauma that's been basically coming forward after seeing how the country is reacting to this.
And Amy, are you seeing more people coming forward at your organization as well?
I think that we have been placed in an organization where people have been coming to us mm-hmm. all along. I think, you know, nationally, and people being more open about filing complaints with either their employer or with their school. I think that has been one of the benefits of this Me Too movement.
What's interesting to me is we were having a conversation with some college-age students, and one of the things that they keep going back to is, and this came from men and women, college students, so this was not exclusive to men, was that they are afraid to date. They are afraid to move forward in these romantic relationships because they're like, we don't know what the rules are anymore. I was shocked and I wasn't shocked by that, but I had no answers to give them.
I think they're afraid to date because we have done a terrible job of teaching what a healthy potentially sexual relationship is like. And we've done a really bad job about talking about consent. I mean, the majority of states do not require teaching consent with sex education within the public school system. So it's something that parents have to discuss. And a lot of parents are not comfortable and they're not equipped to talk about it.
Melissa.
And I think, too, what's happened, especially in our state, is that we don't have a comprehensive, scientifically based sexual health education program in our schools. And what we've done is we've driven the subject into kind of dark areas. It's taboo to talk about. And anytime we do that, that sets folks up for, I think, miscommunication, misconception, which leads to acts of violence. If we don't create an environment where people understand and know how their body works fully, and understands and has, I think the problem here, too, is that we have not always respected women's autonomy for her body and her choices. We see that even as young girls when we decline a drink in a bar, we don't want to go on a date, we're punished. We're called names. We're bad-mouthed. So we have to not have these subjects in the taboo. We have to bring them in light and control the subject and control the conversation so we can have honest, open discussions instead of driving them in the ground where people then feel fear about myths and misunderstandings.
And I think that's going to go a long ways towards making sure people have pleasurable sexual relationships. Yes. I don't think it's the end-all be-all to ending sexual assault, having discussions about consent, because as you mentioned before, there are definitely situations, and when I've worked with survivors of sexual assault, that their choice is taken away from them. Mm-hmm. What they say and what they indicate they want to happen to their body does not happen to their body. And it's really interesting when people have this fear of, I can't even interact with people that I'm sexually interested in anymore because I don't know what the rules are. I think that that's an overblown fear because what we're looking at aren't the gray area. Mm.
And, Melissa. And I guess I would just add to that. So we have to think about how we are socializing boys and girls young, right? And how do we socialize boys in general? We talk about this in my gender studies class. For years, I've taught this class. The definition of what a real man and real woman is has not changed really that much for these students. It's as if they pull out a book and they're reading mm-hmm. from it. But if we have to think about if we're socializing boys to be competitive, strong, tough, get what you want, beat, win, and we don't teach the girls the same thing. We teach them to be a little more docile. Don't, you know, think before you speak and act. We even have dress codes in high school for girls and not boys necessarily. When we set these things up, we basically are creating, I think, a petri dish for some really terrible things to happen. Because then if I'm taught to beat, win, compete, get what I want, and the girl isn't, then I'm going to go into a relationship at all costs. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to disregard my partner's choices and her physical autonomy or his physical autonomy, right? And this then is about power and control.
And don't you think, though, too, on the flip side of that, I think it's not only teaching girls the things that you said to teach boys, but to teach boys about it's okay to be sensitive.
Empathy.
It's okay to have these feelings. I don't believe in it, and I am raising boys, but I don't think we do a good job in our society of allowing boys to have those so-called female emotions. And Megan, do you see that in what you teach?
I mean, I think just all our attitudes about sex and, you know, what's normal and what's not is so entrenched in stereotypes, and the language that we use matters. So what I talk about is how important it is to use for little kids. It's important to make sure that we're teaching them the proper names of their body parts. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a lot of the slang words that we use for male genitalia and female genitalia, if you step back and look at those slang terms, a lot of the words for male anatomy are really aggressive and kind of violent and dominating with those slang terms. And then for women, we have the two polar opposites We have more like floral, feminine, beautiful names for female genitalia, and the polar opposite, which would be something like gross and shameful mm-hmm. and dirty. And so I mean, even that, just the little cutesy words that we use for our children's body parts, instead of just going ahead and saying what they are called, we are imposing those cultural positions and they're dysfunctional. And it starts at the core of just figuring out what is the name of my parts of my body. And it goes from there. And so I think it's important to really kind of look at what are we teaching our kids? How are we doing it? How am I bringing all of that baggage that I have learned, all those cultural norms that are mm-hmm. not healthy, not normal, and I'm bringing them into the conversation with my child early on. And it takes some knowledge. It takes some unlearning of that. And that's what I try to convey to the parents that teach or that take my class, that we need to step back and we need to look at how am I talking about these things with my son? How am I talking about them with my daughter? And am I bringing in that baggage, that shame that we're trying to eliminate in the sex positive education world?
We are continuing our conversation about sex positivity and consent. We're having this conversation in light of what is going on Capitol Hill with Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh being accused of sexual assault as a teenager. My guests today include Megan Cole, a licensed counselor who focuses on consent and sex positivity, State Representative Melissa Wintrow. Her career background is the former Women's Studies Director at Boise State University. She currently teaches a gender studies class at Boise State. And Annie Hightower, Director of Law and Policy for the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. And I want to begin this conversation, Megan, with you, because you talk about there is a difference, you say, between consent, which is what we seem to be talking about quite a bit today, is what is consent. But you say there's a difference between consent and enthusiastic consent.
Yeah, I think it would be great if we could just be talking about consent, period. But it needs to go one step further. So if we get fixated on consent means yes, which it does, I have seen numerous accounts where women have had their car keys taken, their cell phone taken, they're in a location that they are unfamiliar with, and they are basically forced to say yes to some sort of sexual act in order to gain their freedom back. And so the person that is trying to engage in some sort of sexual act will claim, well, I heard a yes, therefore he or she consented, and therefore what I did is not bad. And what we need to teach our children is that consent needs to be given enthusiastically. And what that means is that somebody is a willing, enthusiastic participant in the sexual act. They want to be a part of it. It's good. It's healthy. It's enjoyable. It's mutually beneficial. And yes, I really want to be a part of this. If we frame the conversation in that way, we're going to see less people kind of manipulating for the yes, coercively getting entitled for the consent,
all of that.
If we are fixated on the words yes only without actually getting the enthusiastic part in there, we're going to still see abuses of power and manipulation.
And Amy, do you see this?
And I would add to that and say that there needs to be that voluntary consent, non-coerced, enthusiastic consent, but that there also needs to be an understanding of what you're consenting to.
Yes.
Mm. Because that's what I see or have seen a lot, is that there's a consent for some level of activity, but there wasn't understanding on how far, what could happen, right, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And so often what I would say is seeing going beyond the bounds of consent. So there needs to be an agreement about the particular activity that will happen.
Melissa.
And I guess I would add, from the gender studies perspective, when I listen to this conversation, I'm thinking about, who are we targeting this conversation for consent? Are we still trying to teach boys to stop being so aggressive and to seek the consent versus the other way around? I just don't think we have the sexual dynamics or the social politics right now where women are on even footing to be the ones that are asking for consent, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. So if we look at all these sexual assault cases, it's mostly men who are crossing physical boundaries without consent. Right. And when I worked on college campus, I also heard women talking about being begged to the point where they were, well, I would call it coercion, just mm-hmm. over and over and over. That's not a free and willing, enthusiastic yes. And then when we add some of the dynamics we're hearing in this Supreme Court decision, mm-hmm. It doesn't even get near to me as far as any environment where somebody could grant a mutual mm-hmm. consent.
Well, and then we go to the part, though, that so many parents are fearful of talking about this with their kids, from talking about just that basic birds and the bees conversation to just having an ongoing conversation about sex, because there seems to be this idea that if we talk about it all the time, then we are maybe allowing our children to go down the path of promiscuity. Mm-hmm. And I would beg to differ on that, just from research that I've read. And Megan, yeah. you being the expert when it comes to this, mm-hmm. what are you finding with A, are parents afraid to talk about it because of the ramifications of it? And do they think that it will lead to something that they don't want their children to get involved in?
Yeah, I think that it is always a concern that if I talk about it, does that mean I'm okay with them doing it? And so what I advocate for is to allow parents to have a conversation about values. And so help your child come up with their own sexual values for themselves. You can be influential in that. You can, you know, have a very strong opinion on it, but allow them the freedom to come up with their own personal sexual values. And oftentimes they're going to mimic your families, but just giving them permission to come up with it themselves, we find that kids are less likely to be impulsive, less likely to be promiscuous. They're going to stick to those personal sexual values that they've come up with themselves. And also, especially teenagers, if you're giving them permission to choose something on their own, they're going to be really passionate about it and really follow it. If you tell them you have to wait until fill in the blank, they are more likely to say, no, that's not what mm-hmm. I want to do. It's on my terms. And they'll do the exact opposite, almost just, you know, mm-hmm. in spite of you.
And I have to say, when I was growing up, my dad would always say to us, and I'm one of 10 kids, so he had some experience raising kids. And he would say, if I don't trust you, how will I ever expect anyone else to trust you? So you need to make the right decision. And I never wanted, and I know other kids may not have been like that, but I was like, they're entrusting me with something. And so does that go to your point, Megan?
Well, I mean, you don't want, yes, but the thing about sex positivity is you eliminate the shame and the guilt mm-hmm. and the negativity that is frequently a part of the abstinence-only sex ed or the purity culture that is kind of more religiously based. And so you're going to be, it's really important that parents do not place that shame and negativity and judgment on a child's decisions when it comes to their sexuality, because I work with a lot of women who are in a relationship or not that have been greatly negatively impacted on that shame, and it stays with them forever.
And then you wonder why women don't report.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, with that, if parents are going to have those open conversations with their kids, other people will, or they're going to see projections of what sexuality should look like in the media. And again, I think when we have these conversations, you can't take gender and power relationships out of the equation. You have to look at the context of the culture we live mm-hmm. in. And I want to ask, how many times are we actually discussing with women their bodies and not in, beyond a reproductive fashion and the pleasure and the power they might experience? Yes, I went there, but I think that is the important thing, and that creates power, autonomy, and empowerment for women. But if we are continue to be not shared about our bodies at an early age, we will develop shame. We won't know how they work. We won't understand pleasure. We'll only believe that our bodies are tools for reproduction. And that's not the case. I mean, I really went there on your show today.
No,
but
why we wanted to have you on, is to talk yeah. just about this.
Right. And I think the other thing is, too, when we look at gender and sex, we have a binary structure where we only, you know, when a baby's born, we look at genitalia and we say it's boy or girl. We're not, as a culture, really organized or recognizing the vast diversity of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And that if we can create environments where everybody feels like they can belong, people are gay, lesbian, transgender, etc., we're going to create more positive environments where power and control is eliminated. And then we're having these sex positivity talks. Right now, it's saturated in power.
And what was shocking to me, and Megan, you talked about this in the very beginning of the program, was that in most states, sex education, we we talk about the basics. I mean, the fundamentals of this is how it works. And that's it.
Yeah. So many states use the abstinence-only education model. It was really big in the early 2000s, and it really hasn't gone away. It's really pointless. You're not getting any information in regards to just health and safety with STDs, birth control. And then you're also getting just layers and layers of shame and guilt and negativity and really mixed messages on what your personal value is, especially for women. You're getting that my sexual status, my virginity is literally the most important thing about me. And then if that gets damaged and we don't talk about how that could be damaged, whether I decide to have sex with somebody on my own accord or I have been sexually abused, there's no differentiation with that. Then I feel awful. My self-worth is in the tank. I don't come forward because sex is bad and dirty, so I don't talk about it with anybody. And we have a lot of people that are suffering in silence. But if we open it up, the topic itself, start tackling some of these things in terms of the power structure and the divide between genders and then also the need to just be inclusive with gender and sexuality, if we open it all up and do more of a full compass sex education, the comprehensive sex ed, then we're going to get solid information. But to add to the comprehensive sex ed, we really need to add that sex positivity, which is consent, pleasure. It is about healthy relationships. All these things help individuals differentiate between good relationship, bad relationship, solid consent, no consent. And then we can sit and like tackle all of the really awful, dysfunctional, cultural and powerful mm-hmm. forces that are going on right now that are really making this difficult.
And don't you think that men and women need to be having these conversations?
Definitely.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we are not helping society if we're not having the same conversations with across the gender spectrum mm-hmm. with what consent looks like, what having a discussion with your partner around sexual activity looks like, how to tell if someone is actually enjoying what's happening. We're not having those discussions, and it is not helping any of us, especially when we're talking about, teenagers and college students who have not had many relationships in their life and don't know what that may look like. And without having that conversation, without someone talking to them about it and them feeling safe talking to adults about mm-hmm. what a healthy sexual relationship looks like, how do we expect them to get there?
Go ahead,
Melissa. And I think, too, seeing myself as one of those examples, right? So, again, we're not doing a good enough job with people who are gay, lesbian, transgender, and that we're talking about male-female relationships and dynamics, but we have to open that so mm-hmm. everybody sees they're included. And I think that's really telling because the teen suicide rate for LGBTQ students is probably one of the highest. So we have to open those conversations so everybody belongs and we all see ourselves represented in the main culture, not just a segment.
And does that come back to when we start having these conversations with our children? Because I think a lot of parents think, well, if I talk to them when they're teenagers, and I'm thinking the bus has already left the station at that point.
Well, we can talk about consent successfully with two-year-olds. I mean, it's very easy to talk about the early forms of consent and healthy boundaries with a two- and a three-year-old about who is allowed,
who touches you,
but also the most important part of that is context, because there are a lot of really close people in our children's lives that can abuse that relationship. So what I mean by that is, let's say you say it's safe for mommy or daddy to touch your private parts, but then you need to say why and how and when. Give that context, whether it be if something doesn't feel right, you're mm-hmm. hurt, you need help cleaned up or bathing or whatever it is. And then usually it's, and also you can have a doctor touch your private parts as well. Well, there are a lot of people who have family friends and family members who are doctors that could easily abuse that position. So you need to explain to have a doctor go ahead and examine you in a doctor's office when mommy or daddy are in the room with you. You know, give mm-hmm. those context, give that context for that child so that they can hopefully identify again, this is okay, this is not okay. It's really easy to start at a very early age with our children.
And hopefully if we start that conversation young, maybe we will move the dial on this conversation. Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes directly to, even as young kids, you can teach autonomy, you know, physical autonomy, like, you know, touching each other as well as taking your crayons. Right.
Right.
And again, are there, and I think as parents, teachers, educators, we look to see who feels more entitled to do that and ask ourselves questions to why and how do we reconstruct so everyone is on a level playing field instead of not.
I want to thank you for coming in today. I think we could take the entire hour talking about this, but I do appreciate your time, all of you. Megan Kohler, a licensed counselor who focuses on consent and sex positivity. State Representative Melissa Wintrow, she was also the former director of the Women's Studies Program at Boise State University, and Annie Hightower, Director of Law and Policy for the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thank you all for coming in and having this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.